We're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians chapter 13 this morning, as you noted was read today. So I hope you'll turn there and follow along as basically 1 Corinthians 13 is my outline today. I want you to think about a couple of things. First of all, Paul is here asking the Corinthians to choose not just what is good or what is better, but really what is best. He wants us to aim high when he talks about love. Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and following tells us to always be thinking about that which is excellent and to reflect on those things and to keep those things in mind. Think about them as well as do them. I believe this particular chapter is the heart and soul of 1 Corinthians. There's a whole lot of what Paul does in here in trying to correct the church of some of its thought processes and beliefs and so forth, and even to the point later on in the book, apparently some people are not even sure about the resurrection. You would think maybe that would be the most important thing. I think everything pivots on chapter 13 because it has so much to do with how they are learning to behave toward one another. And Paul says, love is the most excellent way. The greatest of these is love. Love endures. How could it be otherwise that love is probably the most important thing Paul mentions to the Corinthians here? He does, in fact, by talking about love, exhort them to choose what is excellent. I'm going to break this down into three parts today. First of all, verses 1 through 3, and we'll see that love is really an essential thing. In verses 4 through 7, he will tell us that love is basically an effective behavior. And in verses 8 through 13, he will tell us love never ends. First of all, love is essential. I would even use a different word here in verses 1 through 3. I would say love is not only essential, the way Paul is describing it and in the context in which he writes this to this particular church, love is very provocative. Paul makes some very provocative statements here because he tells us all these different things that in one sense are of value to the Christians. He says, they're nothing unless you have love. The first thing he talks about is the gift of tongues. One of the charismatic gifts that is certainly in the first century was one of those very demonstrable things that would demonstrate the presence of the Holy Spirit. If you spoke in tongues, everybody knew it, or at least it was very visible. People could see that you did it. The problem is, tongues, like a lot of other good things, they can appeal to perhaps more sinister motives. In this case, they could just appeal to the fact that they are very showy. And it was like, hey, look what I got. For the bearer of the gift of tongues, it could be kind of a status symbol of God's blessing. It seems that may be what's going on in Corinth. They're valuing the gift of tongues over a lot of other things. There are a number of little clues that tell us this in the book of 1 Corinthians. And yet, listen to what the apostle says about them. He says, without love, tongues are nothing more than loud, meaningless noise. He uses two things. He says, a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. I don't know. It just seems to me that's not even music. That's just noise. It's not even some sort of inspirational kind of putting together of the notes to make it sound pleasant or inspiring. He says tongues are just noise if you don't have love. Well, that's a pretty challenging statement on the part of the apostle. But he's not done. Then he talks about, in verse 2, he talks about prophecy, even faith. Prophecy, he says, can be something to understand mysteries and give one knowledge. That would be something, I'm guessing, that the Corinthians would value. Certainly, mysteries has overtones of people who have sort of insight into some pagan mysteries. There were a lot of what were known as the mystery religions back in that particular time. And, maybe culturally, they would have felt that having some clues to mysteries, even if they're God's mysteries, the real things, might even make it more so, but there might have been some sort of social thing that would give that a certain status, that you have insight to mysteries. Okay, so again, we're looking at something that might end up having a certain show and might be prized because of it. Paul will go on to say, how about faith? He even says, if I have faith that can remove mountains. And that one kind of strikes you very strange, because Jesus himself said, did he not, that if you had enough faith, you could move mountains. Well, look at what the apostle is saying here. Even if you got that, and if you don't have love, I am nothing. Whoa, you know, Paul's, I don't know, it just seems to me these are some of the most provocative statements in the whole New Testament. That's Bob Weber's opinion, but he really is sort of knocking the foundations out of some cultural things here. And let's face it, we prize knowledge among our fellowship, and it's not a bad thing that we prize knowledge, because we're people who are searching for and want to know very clearly the truth. But to prize that above what love is, Paul says, you know, does he not say in chapter 8 and verse 1 that knowledge puffs up, but love builds up? So there's always a sort of cautionary tale behind some of these things that people are valuing. And Paul, again, he says, even though we can aspire to knowledge, we can aspire to faith, be careful. If you don't have love, you're still nothing. It just doesn't work. But then he goes on to say, in verse 3, as if the other two things weren't enough, he talks about a life of self-sacrifice and generosity and benevolent giving. Probably, you know, giving away our possessions, giving things to others to help them, martyrdom. Paul will even mention, you know, giving your body to be burned. Those are sort of worthy goals of discipleship, aren't they? They're things that perhaps we would aspire to again. Good works, benevolence, generosity, self-sacrifice, they virtually define what it means to behave in a Christian way. And yet, still, I'm just going to read it. But have not love, I gain nothing. That is just, to me, again, a reflection of Paul's provocative nature here, what he's trying to say. A number of these things, and this may be the problem, they are prone to self-righteousness and pride. That seems to be the problem here. Love is being elevated. Clearly is being elevated. And it's very much things that Paul is saying here are going to be essential things that are addressing the problems the Corinthians have. When we get into the next section, verses 4 through 7, love is basically an effective behavior. It becomes clear, first of all, Paul is not being exhaustive here in his definition of love. It's a pretty good one, but he's not being totally exhaustive, because I think he's addressing what's happening in the Corinthian church among everyone there. He will say, for example, love does not envy. But if you go back in chapter 3 and verse 4, where there's, you know, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, etc., etc., you know, envy and strife seem to characterize the church. He says, love doesn't boast. But if you go back to chapter 4, verse 7, and chapter 5, verse 6, it seems they are boasting. That's exactly what's happening in it. They're boasting about these gifts that they have. They're boasting, even in chapter 5, about immoral behavior. Somehow them being tolerant of certain immoral behavior is a cause for their braggadociousness. Love is not puffed up, but they are. They're puffed up against one another, their pride, and they're setting themselves against one another by having all these different gifts, and they think, I'm better than so-and-so because I got the such-and-such a gift. Love is not self-seeking. And Paul himself says that's not the way he operates his ministry. He says, just as I try to please everyone in everything, I do not seeking my own advantage, but that of many, that they may be saved. So you see, Paul's even modeling in his own life. He's trying to get them to see, you know, there's a behavior aspect to love that you need to be emulating that's really more important than all these other things. Love does not delight in wrongdoing, but in chapter 6, they're defrauding one another in court cases. Now, Paul in other places, and John and others will have some other clarifications of what love is. John chapter 15 and verse 3 says, you know, people will know you're my disciples by how much you love one another. In Romans chapter 13 and verse 10, Paul will say, love is a fulfillment of the law. In 1 John chapter 3, 16 and 18, John will say, love does things. It doesn't just say things, it does things. Love behaves beyond simply what it feels. And you see, patience and kindness are the first behaviors we see there. Now, this whole section, it seems to me, is worthy of, probably each one of these things is worthy of a lesson and a discussion all in itself. I don't have time to do that here, but I just want you to see that these, in fact, are behaviors. The first two are behaviors that love is. The next several things are either things that love does not do or that love is not. So he takes a kind of negative approach, but it still assumes that these things are behavioral items. These are not ways love behaves. I don't know if it's significant that he has more ways that love doesn't behave, because he's perhaps sort of insinuating that's kind of what he's seeing there in Corinth. But the fact is, love does not behave in certain ways. And then he has this sort of flourish at the end of it. Love bears, believes, hopes, and endures all things. Love provides the foundation for the struggles that people have. Love provides the means by which we're able to get through those things and still have somewhat of a relationship with other people. Because love bears all things. Love it believes all things. Love hopes all things. And love endures all things. But I think one of the other things that we have here reflected is the fact that the nature of God is reflected in all these things. You know, we talk about God's love, and to me, it kind of gets sort of lofty and ethereal and maybe almost intangible. I don't know that I've ever, I don't know how to say this. I can't feel the love of God because God's there in a spiritual way. He's not there physically with me, okay? So for me at least, I think what he's saying here is that when love gets sort of enfleshed in all of these ways, that's when we begin to really experience the love of God, when we see it and feel it in other people. And the fact that love endures and never ends, that to me clearly reflects and participates in the very nature of God who lives and reigns forever and ever. There's a clear connection here, I think, between love and God. Well, and we kind of know this, but Paul is making the point, I think, a little more strongly in the context of people who kind of aren't getting it. And he's trying to make that point clear. But it's important here that we understand anybody can do this. We're not talking about those who are invested with some particular spiritual gift who are the only ones who know how to do this, who are the only ones who know how to participate in the life of God. If you want to participate in the life of God, you can do these things. And it's really, well, I was going to say, it's really not that hard. It's not that, no, it isn't that hard. Maybe that's the way I want to say it. We think it is. We make it harder for ourselves. It's not some that you need some spiritual insight or some spiritual gift or some special presence of God to do these things. God is present in these things when we do them. In fact, love is more of a manifestation of God's presence than anything else. John 13, verse 35. They will know that you are my disciples if you love one another. You can fill in the blank because we all know the passage. But he finally says something in the last few verses that would tell us that love is eternal. We've kind of touched on it because we sense from what he's saying here that it's in the nature of God to be that way. Love never ends. Verse 8. Love is the greatest for a reason. Verse 13. It triumphs over everything. Maybe I want to take a little different tack, but I want to try to apply this in a way that maybe makes a little more sense to you, and maybe you can see the practical side of it, the practical application. We are we not, tempted by transitory pleasures, things that would make us feel good in the moment. They satisfy our impulses and maybe our more immediate needs. So why not? It'll make me feel good. You know, the phrase that used to be bandied about in the 60s and 70s. Yes, I'm showing my age, sorry. If it feels good, do it. That was clearly an appeal to the immediate moment of things and how you felt at the moment. But you see, love demands that we look beyond the immediate gratification of our impulses. When he says love is patient and it endures all things, love enables us to do better than give in to those sinful impulses. Because love is patient and love is kind and love endures. We want something that endures. We want to avoid those transitory pleasures. Well, how do we do that? We learn to love. I don't know if that sounds counterintuitive or not, because when we say, if it feels good, do it, it feels like we're appealing to our feeling of love. You know, I love how it makes me feel. I love doing those things, but that's not real love. It's not what Paul is telling us is real love here. Even some of the spiritual gifts Paul is telling us here in this section, those things are going to end. What's the one thing that goes on? Love continues on, even when those things do not. And so love becomes the definitive, eternal thing that any one of us can do, if we only will adopt these particular principles. And if we will perhaps deny the immediate impulses we get to do a certain thing, but look at what love is, it becomes a whole lot different. Our perspective is totally changed when we see what love really is. Well, then Paul goes on to say in this section, not only is love eternal, but love puts away childish things. He says, when I became a man, I put away childish things. Now, I tend to think that what the apostle here is doing, this may be sort of an insinuated rebuke. You know, he doesn't say when you grow up, you'll behave differently, but it certainly implies that, doesn't it? He says, when I grew up, I put away child. Paul's using himself as an example, and it's almost like saying, guys, what about it? You know, maybe it's time for you to grow up too. Because that's what adults do. They grow up. They get rid of things that are childish things. I want to read to you a section from a book that I have read recently. And the person that wrote it was a Navy SEAL. I've kind of made reference to this book a couple months ago. His name is Eric Greitens. And he wrote a book called Resilience. And in this book, he's talking about he's writing letters back to another former Navy SEAL, and he's trying to get him to kind of come out of the difficulties that he's having as a war veteran, as a, you know, as a former Navy SEAL, and now he's doing some other things, and he's struggling in his life. And so it's kind of based on some letters that he's written back and forth to this particular individual. One of the things he talks about in this particular case is mentors, okay? And what he says in this, among other things, is that SEAL training embodies the possibility of transformation. It's about turning a young man focused on himself into a warrior built to protect society. Now, as I read through this, he's going to use the term warrior for the person that's more mature, but I think we can justifiably, in some of these things, replace the word mature person. Okay? I'm going to read the word warrior. You insert the word mature person as we read through it. And by the way, when he talks about the word warrior, he's not talking about some sort of bloodthirsty animal. He's talking about a person who grows up and learns to protect others. That's his idea of a warrior. And that's mostly what they teach these guys who are Navy SEALs and Army Rangers and so forth. You know, they're not just out there to just, they're not out there for bloodlust. And I wouldn't imagine there might be a few in there who are, but they train them not to be. It's about protection. So listen to what he says. When the child is skillful, he boasts. When the warrior has skill, he teaches. When the child is strong, he attacks the weak. When the warrior is strong, he protects the weak. The child criticizes others to make himself feel better. The warrior is his own most demanding critic. The child brandishes symbols as a substitute for substance. The warrior knows that it is not in his position, his rank, his education, or his warfare pin that makes him a man, but his honor. The child serves himself. The warrior serves others. The child relishes gossip. The warrior speaks through action. The child never makes mistakes. The warrior admits his mistakes and corrects them. The child's character is cloudy. The warrior's character is clear. If the child can recognize that he needs teaching, he may one day become a warrior. When the warrior meets the child, he seeks the teaching. Seems to me there's some pretty good contrasts in there, and you can interject love in there somewhere too, in terms of humility and patience and what the warrior does, okay? I thought that was a rather interesting adaptation of what I'm trying to say here about Paul says to them, you guys, it's time for you to grow up. The practice of love is always the process of growing up. You look at some of those characteristics and clearly it's all there in maturity. And so my encouragement today simply is love one another. It's the most excellent way. Everybody can do this. You can do this. Adopt these definitions as model behaviors. And remember, God himself is love. He gave his son. Seems to me that ought to be reason enough to imitate exactly what he does.